Earhart suits. Through his helmet earphones, Jamie could hear Craig sighing and moaning, like a neighborhood repairman trying to figure out just how high an estimate he could get away with and still be awarded the job. "Fuel cells completely gone," Craig muttered. "Sometime later. Batteries ain't worth shit now." When they went out again and clambered up the ladder built into the front module's flank to inspect the solar panels, Craig's voice went from somber to dismal. "Y'all ain't gonna get diddly squat from these guys." By the time they had come back inside the dome and gotten out of their suits, Jamie was ready to write off the rover completely. But Craig rubbed a hand across his stubbly chin and said, "Well, boss honcho, if the drill rig keeps on behaving itself and the creek don't rise, I can get her running in about a week, I imagine." Surprised, Jamie blurted, "A week? Give or take a couple of days." "Really?" Jamie sat on the bench that ran the length of the hard suit lockers. Craig nodded sagely and planted one foot on the bench beside Jamie. "Her structural integrity's okay. We got replacement batteries and solar panel spares in the supplies. Enough. Gotta check out the inventory on the computer and then find the sumbitches in the cargo bay, but we ought to be okay." "Great. Her fuel cells are a pain in the butt," Craig complained. "Old style. Run on hydrogen and oxy. We'll have to electrolyze some of the water from the backup recycler, I expect." The fuel cells in the newer rovers used methane and oxygen, Jamie knew. "Funny thing," Craig went on. "I was more worried about damage to the windshield, you know, pitting or even crazing from the sandstorms. But you had her front end buried nice and cozy in the sand, so the windshield's okay." Jamie got to his feet a little shakily. "I never thought..." "Electrical stuff we got backups for," Craig went on. "But if that windshield had gone, that'd be all she wrote." When he checked the comm center, Jamie saw Rodriguez sitting at the communications console with a glum look on his swarthy face, and he noticed that the young astronaut seemed to be trying to grow a mustache. His upper lip sported a sprinkling of short, dark hairs. "¿Qué tal, Tomás?" Rodriguez looked up at him with an almost guilty expression. "Troubles, man." "What's the matter?" Jamie asked, pulling up the other wheeled chair to sit next to him. "I lost contact with number 2. "The soar plane?" Jamie felt a twinge of apprehension in his guts. Rodriguez nodded unhappily. "Been trying to reestablish contact. No go." "Where was the plane?" "Recce flight over Olympus Mons." The unmanned soar plane was mapping out the huge volcano for Fuchida's upcoming mission to its peak. "What happened?" The astronaut shook his head. "I've been going over the flight record. Hit some turbulence while she was climbing through 20,000 meters, but then it cleared up." Olympus Mons was nearly 30,000 meters tall, more than 3 times taller than Mount Everest. "Might have been wind shear," Rodriguez guessed. "But up at that altitude, the air's so thin it shouldn't be a problem." "How long has the plane been out of contact?" Jamie asked. Rodriguez glanced at the digital clock set into the comm console. 53 minutes 54. Jamie let out his breath. "Well, we got number 1, and a backup in storage, at least." "Only the 1 backup. We'll have to use it if number 2 is down." "Yeah, I know, but I don't want to send the backup out to the mountain until I figure out what went wrong with number 2. Jamie pushed himself to his feet. Looking down at Rodriguez's somber face once more, he grasped the younger man's sturdy shoulders. "Don't blame yourself for this, Tomas. It isn't your fault." The astronaut shook his head sadly. "How do you know?" For the first time in almost 2 weeks, all 8 of the explorers sat together for dinner. Trumbull monopolized the conversation with his plans for recovering the Pathfinder's Sojourner hardware at Ares Vallis. He and Rodriguez got into a heated discussion on how reliable the backup fuel generator's landing engines were. "I don't care what the computer simulations say," Rodriguez said with unaccustomed fervor. "You're going to be putting your necks on the line based on what some engineer assumed and put into the simulation program." Jamie knew that the astronaut was feeling the shock of losing the unmanned soar plane. "You mean," Trudy Hall corrected, "what some programmer assumed out of the engineer's assumptions." "And they both worked for the company that built the rocket engines," Stacy DeGirova pointed out. Ah, come on, Trumbull disagreed. We've got test data, for Christ's sakes. They fired those engines dozens of times. Jamie let them argue. Let Tomas work off some steam about the plane. He's blaming himself for losing it, or at least for not being able to figure out what happened to it. Let him argue and make some points for safety and caution. It'll do us all some good. Jamie had decided to buck the decision on flying the backup generator to Pete Connors and the rocket experts back on Earth. Trumbull wasn't going to go traipsing off to Ares Vallis unless the top experts in the field agreed that the generator could be flown reliably and be positioned where they needed it for the excursion. But Dex seemed to have every angle figured out. He's been working on this plan for a long time, Jamie thought, probably from before we took off from Earth. He's shrewd, all right. A very clever guy. Across the table from Jamie sat Vijay Shekhtar, as silent as he was. Her eyes were on Trumbull, who was putting on an animated defense of his idea against the combined doubts of both the astronauts and Possum Craig. Craig's attitude amused Jamie. He muttered darkly, "Murphy's Law, Dex. If anything can go wrong, it will. And you'll be a hell of a long way from help when it does." Trumbull was utterly undeterred by such cautions. Jamie realized, though, that Craig had hit the sensitive point squarely. Expedition regulations required that no excursion be made so far from base that a backup team could not reach a stranded rover. If Trumbull got into difficulties all the way out at Ares Vallis, there would be no way to rescue him. Unless Stacy or Rodriguez could fly the rocket plane out to them. Even at that, the plane could only carry two people at a time. We'd need two rescue flights. Dicey, Jamie thought. Very dicey, but just good enough to squeeze through the safety regs. Nodding to himself, Jamie realized again that Dex had worked out every angle of this trek to Ares Vallis. Jamie turned his gaze back to Vijay, who was still watching Trumbull with an amused half-smile on her lips. If Dex wants to risk his ass, so what? Jamie thought. Then he remembered that Dex would not go alone. Too bad, he thought, and immediately felt guilty about it. Night. Sol 18. And that's the plan, Dad, Dex Trumbull said into the pin mic hanging a few millimeters before his lips. You can start soliciting bids for hardware that's been sitting on Mars for more than a quarter of a century. Ought to bring in a few megabucks, huh? Trumbull was sitting on the bunk in his quarters, laptop resting on his knees, earplug and microphone connected to the machine. Not that he was afraid of anyone overhearing him, although the privacy walls of these cubicles did not extend to the dome ceiling, of course. Nor did he expect a quick reply from his father. The distance to Earth defeated that. Besides, he knew his dad. The old man would want to think this over for a while before answering his son. Dex felt quite confident that his father would be impressed with his idea. Retrieving the Pathfinder and his little Sojourner rover would be a masterstroke. He could picture the frenzied bidding by museums and entertainment moguls all around the world. Dad's got to like it, he told himself. It's money in the bank. Darrell C. Trumbull was in his office, talking on the phone with the head of his London office. Real estate values in Eastern Europe were nosediving again, and the elder Trumbull saw opportunity smiling upon him once more. Buy cheap, sell dear. That had been his guiding principle all his life. It had never failed him. One wall of Trumbull's office was a huge window, with a sweeping view of Boston Harbor. He could make out the masts of Old Ironsides at its pier in Charleston. Trumbull tested his eyesight that way every clear day. The opposite wall was a smart screen that could show panoramic views of anything he chose to look at. He had shown his staff the videos of Mars his son had sent to him personally. They had all been dutifully impressed. At the moment, most of the smart wall was blank. Only the sleekly handsome face of the head of the London office was showing in one corner. "I'm afraid the French are doing their best to make things sticky for us," said his London office chief dolefully. "In what way?" Trumbull asked. The man was the picture of a dapper English upper-class type, silver hair, trim mustache, Savile Row suit jacket. He replied, They've dug up some rather antique European Union requirements about tax rates on property.